Hey, welcome all you wiretappers. Good to be back here in the studio of Gangland Wire. I've got my good friend Camillus Robinson, Cam Robinson. Welcome, Cam. Good to see you. I haven't
Hey,
talked to you for a while.
Gary, I can't tell you how much it means to me to be back and be back in the studio with you. It's such a great time, and I'm glad to be here, and I'm really excited about today's show.
Really good. Yeah, we're gonna do Jimmy the Bomb Keturah. Is that how you pronounce that, Cam? Keturah?
Qatar, yeah,
Keturah? Okay.
that's how I'd say, yes. So, and you know how everybody laughs about how I drag out my vowels up here.
Not as bad, much as they'd laugh about me. One guy said, "Well, that hillbilly twang, that guy's God." He said, "Man, he can't be telling me about the mafia."
I had to get everybody to help me out with the Choi
Oh, yeah, you did do
Ayupa.
that.
And
You do that
I
one a
am
little bit
Italian.
off
I've
for a
got no
while.
I am Italian. I've got no excuse.
Yeah, see, I'm full excuse. Anyhow, we're going to talk about Jimmy the Bomber Couture, and Cam, he came over as a child, I believe, from Sicily. Now, if I'm wrong on that, let me know, guys, but it looks like he was naturalized after he got here, but probably as a young man or a child. He got married, had a couple kids, and we're talking about the 20s. By 1929, he is in his early 20s, I believe, and the stock market crashes, and he's a young guy, got a couple of kids trying to scuffle out a living. And kind of an interesting note I found on that: when the stock market crashed, banks weren't lending out money. And you know what happened when the banks quit lending out money? That's when the loan shark business started. I never put that together before. Did you, Cam? Do you ever think about that?
I didn't in that capacity. It's interesting how there was such a conglomeration of so many different things that went into in that time period. Like you said, the banks collapsed, the alcohol became illegal, all the immigrants started pouring into the country, and that confluence of different things really is what blew up what we came to know is the mafia. It was just the perfect storm that led
Yeah.
to all these rackets that blew up. I mean, it really was the time and the place to start an organized crime empire.
Really. And loan sharking, if you think about it, you had all those Sicilian immigrants, and the banks were all ran by the English and the Germans, and they're not going to loan anything to the newly arrived immigrant. Plus, the immigrant can't read the paperwork and probably can't speak the language. So, the loan sharking business, was going to come up. It was really interesting. And with bootlegging
Right.
and a variety of other things. Of course, there was some narcotics business going on at the time coming out of Cuba, going up through the Midwest and in New York, and that was all by the mafia. So, it was a perfect storm for that. He ends up being, they list him in the census in the 1930 census as a presser in a tailor shop, but pretty a few years later, he's a retail meat market owner, and then he's an inmate in the Illinois State Penitentiary during this time. So,
He's a real Renaissance man.
he's a Renaissance man. He's a man for all seasons. The census did indicate he had completed the fourth grade. So he wasn't, like most of these guys, they didn't go, if they went to high school, that was back then especially, hardly anybody went to high school unless you were of a certain class. All the working class kids, you went to eighth grade, ninth grade, and then you were
Went to
working.
work.
So that's what he did, but he was maybe not a genius scholar, Rhodes scholar, or anything like that, but he learned the streets, and he learned it from a guy, which is interesting, a guy named James Belocastro, who was known as the King of Bombers. So he learned from the King of Bombers, and he will eventually become known as the Jimmy the Bomber Keturah. So go figure that, man.
That's right. And Bel Castro was a big deal. And there were a couple of guys who came after Bel Castro who took that name, the bomber. But he had a whole string of bombers that came after Bel Castro.
Matter of fact, one of his early arrests was he and a guy named William Palermo were apprehended with a bomb, and that was in 1933. Even got a little description of it. He had seven sticks of dynamite, and they were going to get ready to go to trial, and the defense would contend that the bomb was planted on them by the cops, which is, I'm not sure how that works, but I guess they were, it'd be possible they'd try to shake them down or something. Those same cops would testify that he had offered him a $1,000 bribe while he was at the police station. So he was doing pretty good early on.
$1,000.
Wow. Yeah, that's a lot of damn money in 1933. Jesus, I don't know how you could resist that in 1933.
I couldn't bribe a cop for $1,000 tomorrow.
Really? They charged him with attempted bribery, and he ended up getting 5 to 25 years. I never understood those indeterminate sentences, but I think it is to keep them better prisoners, because they've got a chance of maybe getting out because you have this indeterminate sentence. So you could be a good prisoner and then have a chance at getting out early, because there's not a locked in time that you have to stay there. Wouldn't you say? Would you hazard a guess on that?
That makes really good sense. I hadn't thought about it. I've seen those sentences before, in the reading that you and I do a lot, and I never really got it. I thought, that was sort of a broad outlining, but it really does make sense, and it is sort of a reason that they should, an incentive for good behavior.
And he was in Chicago, and it seemed like this is the 30s, but Capone had something to do with the dairy business at one time. And arrest was something to do with a string of bombings in the dairy business. So somebody was trying to line up the dairy business back during the 30s, yeah. I would say.
That was Curly Humphreys had a lot to do with that. They figured if you could line up the milk, and milk was everywhere. You had just like with everything, you had the milk unions, and they delivered the milk around, just like with years later in Jersey and places you have the garbage. But if you could line up the milk lobbies, that was one of the first unions that they were known for getting lined up was the milk haulers. And that actually led to several types of legislation for how clean milk had to be and different things. It was really revolutionary how Curly viewed the unions and things.
Yeah, he was a genius. He was smart. He was an organizer. He knew he didn't need to go around beating people up and robbing stores and transporting narcotics and booze was legal by now. But he knew to get into those unions and organize people and extort money from businesses.
Oh, yeah.
Guy was a genius, really. He registered for the draft. They found out in for World War II, but he never served. A lot of guys did serve in World War II, whether you're in the mob or not, but a lot of people served. It's kind of unusual if you didn't. He was a little bit old, actually, I think, to be going in. Now, the next time he gets questioned about bombings, it's about bombing the homes of some brothers that own a paper company, the Victory Paper Company. I'm not sure what that was all about, but it's alleged that that paper company was supplying paper to the policy operators. They had to have paper to write down the bets. Interesting thing, when I was researching the bomber, they described the policy and said the name of policy came from the fact that there were these insurance policies that people pay like 50 cents a week on or 25 cents a week on. They still have that. And so it was a little bit like that. You'd write down their name and get their 25 cents for the wheel for the lottery. And so it looked a little bit like, an insurance policy collector, the guys that went around and collected from all the, 15, 25 cents, 50 cents a week from people. Poor people just want a burial policy. I remember
that's
that,
right.
That's been going on a long time. I think there's still a certain business of that out there.
Oh, yeah.
So anyhow, just a little aside there about the policy. He was arrested and charged with and released, of course, for more bombings in the Chicago area. He bombed a gas station on trying to organize gas station employees to join a union. So the usual kind of mob activities where you need to force people, to intimidate people to join a union or to go on strike or not go on strike or solve a strike or, whatever you need to be done.
Win an election,
this guy would go around and do a little bombing for him. So he had that name righteously, man, Jimmy the Bomber Keturah.
Right.
And he had it all along. Matter of fact, he was questioned about that gas station bombing and the Teamsters. I guess I don't quite understand this. What I read, the Teamsters offered a reward for whoever was planting these bombs. I don't quite understand that, but you never know. You got to look into it a little deeper sometimes.
If you're trying to cover up who did something, you run the gangsters. You know, we'll talk about sort of a little sleight of hand the mob pulled later on. But that sounds like the kind of thing where, you know, if you are the one that does the bomb and you're the one that puts out the reward, it kind of draws the attention away from you.
Here's one of his first murders that they really tried to link to him. And it was a guy that worked for him. He's a part-time, as in a collection agency that he had, you know, kind of his loan shark, somebody's loan sharky business. And he was going out doing some collecting for a loan sharker for his own loan sharky business. And this guy worked for him. That guy was found strangled to death and in his trunk, you know, the old Chicago trunk music. I think they pioneered that. I don't know. So that was one of his first that he was charged or not charged with, but was questioned. So he was, you know, he did have somebody that came up early that challenged him, and that was Albert Tocco.
Yes.
And, you know, he was kind of a South Side guy. And so do you remember when he was kidnapped? This is, we're jumping on into the 70s. I don't know if there's anything else in between.
Yeah, there. In between, you get Al Tocco started into the stolen car racket in the late 60s. He goes into prison. So they're both South Side guys at this time. And you've got Couture is a pretty heavy hitter. He's been around for a long time. Pilato is, Tocco is an up-and-coming guy. He works under Pilato, and he starts this racket. Indiana and parts of Illinois, really the Wild West, their laws regarding switching VIN numbers and keeping track of those records were so lax, and security was just non-existent as far as what was required to for insurance purposes and different things. I mean, so that he discovered this, and the racket really shot through the roof. It became eventually a $30 to $40 million a year racket. But Tocco goes into prison, late 60s. At that point, Jimmy Couture comes and he takes over the racket. I mean, it's sort of in his neighborhood. And so he decides he's going to step up and he's going to take over Tocco's old racket. And he puts together a crew of guys. He's got a guy, Steve Ostrowski, who owns a chop shop. All his guys own chop shops, basically. Richie Ferraro and Joseph Theo, Earl Abercrombie. And his main muscle would be Sam Annarino and obviously Billy Dauber. And Billy Dauber is a psychopathic murderer, and it's always good to have one of those guys if you are a mob heavy hitter. So he puts together this band of guys, and Tocco eventually gets out of prison. And this was around this time before Tocco really. Couture was at loggerheads with Pilato. Tocco thought that I'm sorry. Couture. There's so many vowels. You know, I have a problem with my vowels. So Couture was at loggerheads with Pilato. He thought he was going to take over the Southside crew when Frank LaPorte died. There was a meeting at the back of the funeral home when LaPorte passed, and you've got Paul Waiter, and you've got Tony Cardo, and they come to the conclusion that after Frank LaPorte, it is not going to be Jimmy Couture who takes over the South Suburban crew, the Southside crew. It's going to be Pilato, who becomes the capo down there. And that really, really pushed. That was a really bothersome thing for Couture, who was an old guy, an old school guy, and thought that he really deserved it. And that was about the time that he started taking over Tocco's rackets, because Tocco was Pilato's guy. And he steps into these. He builds up this crew of heavy hitters that we mentioned. Tocco comes out of prison, and Pilato is still having problems with this Couture. And so there was so much money in these chop shops, and all these guys owned their own junkyards. And Katara's guys, around 1976, the dam broke. Pilato and Tocco decide they've had enough, and Katara's got to go. But they can't just take him out because he's got a lot of standing. And believe it or not, there is a lot of respect in that world for the old Sicilian guys. You can't even, you know, and I know that we don't always understand the dynamics of what they consider respect. I mean, you know, Gary, it's weird. But his guys don't hold the same, so they start taking them out one at a time. You know, and almost you get in October this Ostrowski, who was like his right hand man, and then in almost two a month in 1977, two in June, two in July, and then in August, and this is where you really see the Wild Bunch. This is they were the real heavy hitters in taking these guys out until you get to San Marino. That was a real public murder. And the Calabrese crew and the Wild Bunch teaming up. And Katara is watching all his guys die, but they can't kill Katara. So they kidnap him and they sort of warn him, say, you need to, you're done. They're on the shelf.
Interesting.
So that was when they tried to shelf him.
Let's make sure that everybody understands. Now, this is all geographically, this is all in the southwest part of Chicago. And this is Chicago.
Yeah, southwest
this is
going to
be the Chicago Heights crew, right?
Correct. The Chicago Heights crew, the Southside crew, Chicago Heights crew. Yeah, correct. I should have called it the Chicago Heights crew.
Which was ran by Frank LaPorte, goes all the way back to Capone days.
Correct.
And this borders onto Indiana. And so then you've got these different guys out there that have junkyards and, of course, chop shops, you know, body shops, and they're stealing cars. I knew a guy here in Kansas City, he'd steal cars. He'd take them out to a farm and he'd cut them up. And then he had a series of body shops that he was connected to. And they'd actually call him and they'd say, hey, I need a, you know, I need a front clip for a blue Cadillac. Now, this guy would go out and find a blue 72 Cadillac or 82 Cadillac, steal that car, and he'd have part of the parts sold many times. And so then they'd do runs clear up through the mid, all around the Midwest. And so that's what these guys were doing, I have to assume, was cutting them up and then selling them to other body shops.
Anywhere else in the country was really strict on where did these parts come from?
Yeah.
You know, where did you get that front clip? Where did you get that tie rod? Where did you get these different, that right front, that door, that where did you get these parts? And Indiana and Illinois, they were so lax on their record keeping and their requirements that it was literally the Wild West, this specific geographic area, their record keeping methods, it really created the perfect storm. That was kind of what set the stage for this kind of chop shop activity.
So when Blank Report dies, it's the hierarchy, Paul Wader and Tony Accardo, Joe Batters, they meet and, you know, they appoint the next boss of the Chicago Heights crew. And that ends up being Al Pilato, so Jimmy Katura was this old time guy. Now he was, I don't think he was from down there because he got killed way up in the past, really.
Right.
But he had been working down there and now he's out in a way. So, and the Altoco is in and out of jail, who are going to be more important later on in the outfit. But so, now I understand. I never understood these chop shop wars because it was geographically so far away from the patch, from, you know, the guys downtown, from Joy Lombardo and, you know, Cicero and all that I finally got my mind around that. I appreciate that's one reason I wanted to do this show, to help me get my mind around this chop shop wars, because it was so huge. God, they killed so many guys. So I'm sorry. You were at the point that they've kidnapped Jimmy Katura. Held him in a trunk, I think more than a day or two, wasn't it?
And that was to let him know. I mean, when we say you're shelved. We're not going to give you another warning. This is it. You know, and so, because otherwise they would have just killed him. But as you know, we mentioned earlier, there is a strange sort of respect for that it had to exist in that mob world, where they didn't just kill every guy that made them mad. I mean, there were rules. They were obviously broken at times, but there were rules that protected guys, you know, in their own way. I mean, there was a hierarchy, and they didn't just kill Katara. He was an old, well-respected Sicilian guy, and there was a lot of respect for the Sicilians in Chicago. I mean, if you look at what happened after Accardo, basically all the leadership going forward was always Sicilian. So they didn't just kill him. They kidnapped him. They, you know, gave him his walking papers, and that was that for a while. Now, while this is all transpiring, Illinois decides they need to crack down on a lot of this chop shop activity. The Illinois State Police forms a special task force led by a lieutenant, Vladimir Ivkovich. And Ivkovich has his old guys, and they really start going after this chop shop activity in Illinois. I mean, statewide, it's big. And Ivkovich, one day in, I believe it's 78, he finds a bomb outside of his home. Police, and this is state police lieutenant. The bomb is right next to the gas, you know, the gas hookups for his home.
Yeah.
I mean, you as an officer, that's not
cold.
Done.
That is that not is done.
Not
that
done.
Is never done.
So, but what they, and I think that there were some problems. The bomb wasn't such, they said if it had gone off, but it was just sort of sitting there. And I think it wasn't active or whatever. It was just sort of sitting there. A bomb happened to be sitting at the home of the police, the state police lieutenant in charge of the chop shops.
Yeah.
Very shortly thereafter, Jimmy the Bomber Katara is executed walking through Chicago. And then it's not, you know, it was never known who planted the bomb or anything like that. But my theory has always been that Katara wouldn't lay down, wouldn't remain shelved, he wouldn't do what he was told. And so this was used as sort of a justification. There was only one guy in Chicago named the Bomber at that time.
Yeah.
So they leave a bomb, a relatively inert bomb, dangerous but relatively inert. They leave it at the head guy's place, this guy who would really be going after Toko's guys at the time, because Toko had basically won the chop shop wars and was starting in with Lombardo, but that's another story. So that justified the execution of Jimmy the Bomber Katara, because, well, look, guys, he's clearly out of control going after state police. So we had to take him out, and then they don't have to worry about it. They found a reason to kill him, to where they didn't have to worry about the Sicilian respect and all that jazz. And that's what I've always seen. That was always my guess. Obviously, it's not written down. Nobody's talked about it. But I always thought that was a false front that they used to justify killing Katara.
Yeah, Katoko, you know, rather than keep dealing with him, mm-hmm. he might have just put that bomb up there by the,
yes.
He knew whoever put that bomb there, they didn't intend on it going off. They didn't
Correct.
Want too much heat brought down on them, but they knew the heat was going to come down from that bomb. And who's it going to come down on? It's going to come down on Jimmy the Bomber. I mean, that's a really good theory. I would say, I just can't imagine that he would do that. I mean, when you're in that position, you don't really care that much about the police, state police and local police. You kind of worry about the FBI, but by the time you know they're there, it's too late anyhow. They're just serving search warrants and getting your records.
He was an old man at this time. I mean,
yeah.
No, you've seen so.
Yeah, I would say, unless he was a senile old man that thought, right. Well, this is, you know, like he went back to the old days. He thought he was still working for Al Capone or something.
Right, the pineapple primary, you know.
Really? Well, that's a textbook story. You know, it's kind of interesting that they would import guys from another crew, like the Wild Bunch and Jerry Scalise and Harry Aleman and some of those guys. Was it Nicoletti? Some of them would bring them down from the Taylor. Was it the Taylor Street crew, or was that the?
Yeah, they were Cicero,
and then Cicero
there was
crew.
There were two murderous crews out there. It was the Calabrese crew,
yeah.
And the Wild Bunch. They were the two crews.
But still, the Southwest is so geographically isolated from.
Well, and it ran all the way to Gary, Indiana. I mean, they really covered a huge area.
So they probably had a lot of body shops down in Gary, Indiana, more than likely.
Oh yeah, the Chicago Heights crew covered the largest geographic area, with the exception of, I mean, of course, you can say that you know Grand Avenue went all the way out to Vegas, but the largest geographic area was definitely the Chicago Heights crew.
Or you could say some of them went down to Des Moines.
Well, that's right.
They had Louis Fratto down there in Des Moines. So
that's right.
Jerry knows Gioia. I don't know who they were actually. I think they were like kind of their own capo of Des Moines, if you will.
It was so different back then, you know, compared to what eventually evolved to and how things were changed. So, yeah, they were kind of independent operators. But, once it became more structured, yeah, this was just geographically, it was just a massive area.
Yeah. God, the outfit. It's I can't believe there hasn't been more, some kind of movies, decent movies about the outfit. There's so many stories, so many great stories. I keep hearing, and, you know, Bulldog Grumman told me that he had been consulted and there were people working on at one time a movie on Accardo, but it, you know how movies are. You hear about one,
yes.
And then you just never hear about it again. I know two or three like that. People, you find out, you know, they've even like got people saying so-and-so's playing this part, so-and-so's playing this part, this director's on board and all that, and then you just never hear from
then
it
it
again.
Falls through. Exactly.
You just never know how that's going to happen. But anyhow, I really appreciate you helping me with this story. It's just one of those little stories that I've always been confused about, and I figure if I'm confused, there's a lot of mob fans and mob scholars that, you know, are kind of, as I say, call ourselves scholars. A lot of mob interested people, outfit interested people, have heard about all this, the Chop Shop Wars and Jimmy the Bomber, but I never really understood because, like I said, just so geographically disassociated from the rest of the outfit to me that I couldn't quite get it together, how that fit, how that worked together. And I have to assume that whatever they made out there, the Al Pilato, then he was kicking back up to Acarno Iupa later
and,
on.
You know, $30, $40 million a year racket in total. Of course, the mob wants to not lock down as much of that as possible. And so in addition to what was going on between Katara and Toko, they were killing individual guys, just like when they were trying to lock down the street tax. They were doing basically the car theft tax also. It was all part of the same citywide scheme that they were doing. And so it's not always clear who was killed as part of an actual the war and who was killed to get them in line. You know, it was a really messy time that was going on. And you've seen the list. I mean, they were dropping bodies left and right.
Guys, I'll put in the show notes, I'll put a copy of that list. So go to the show notes and you can see all the people, a little bit about how they died. It's kind of interesting. It's kind of frightening in a way that they were killing that many people. Man, and Billy Dauber, of course, he was Keturah's ace number one guy, from what I heard you say. I didn't really quite realize where he fit in. And that was one of the more famous mob murders, really, if you will, because, again, John Drummond almost got to witness that. They were watching. They had a news crew that were filming Billy Dauber coming out of the courthouse. It was one of the other northern county courthouses.
Will County.
And he was coming out, and Drummond wanted to follow him. And he didn't because they had something else downtown. Their producer told him, get on back down to the loop and do something, film something. And Dauber and his wife drive away. And who was in that hit crew was Jerry Scalise.
Well, yeah, everybody. It came out. The Calabrese brothers. And I think you had Shelley. And I mean, you had everybody.
It was a whole crew out there that followed them as they went out. And they lived in a rural area and killed Billy Dauber. He must have.
Billy and Charlotte.
And his wife, too. They must have really been scared of that, Billy Dauber, to go that far to get him. Of course,
I think they've said that. I think Frank Calabrese Jr. remembers his father talking, and he said, oh, he was very dangerous. It was all of us.
Interesting. All right, Cam, you got anything else we need to say about this?
The Chop Shop Wars, it was one of the, I don't know if you remember this, Gary, but you did a show about Harry Alaman, and I got into the Wild Bunch, and that was one of us doing Butch Petroselli, but that really led me down the primrose path into the Chop Shop Wars, and that was really what got me started us working together, and so this is, it's sort of coming back full circle. I mean, is one of the first deep dives that I did for you, and I have so much fun coming on here. I really appreciate it. It's been, you know, and I've had a year, and I really, really love coming on. I'm gonna have to start coming back more regularly.
We'll get you back more regular and do a few more Chicago stories. I've kind of get
absolutely
caught up,
brother.
I did a couple of Kansas City things. I just put one up about the River Key War, and then putting one up about the war between the Savellas and the Sparrows. I did these a long time ago. I thought, well, I'm gonna redo them and put them back up again. So I just did them and kind of.
I saw the one you did about Johnny Green recently.
Johnny Green, yeah. He was killed with two guys. I tell you what, these two guys, they wanted to take out Johnny Green. He lived about a block from Nick Savella, the boss, and they wait for him to come home at night. He had a joint, and he comes in late at night, and he has a garage door opener. And he opens the garage door, and they're standing right around the sides of the garage where you can't see them. To this day, when I pull in my garage, I go ahead and shut the garage door as soon as I get clear inside, because they just step inside and blast him with the shotgun. I mean, you got him trapped right there inside of his car. He can't do anything.
That's a scary thing.
So, yeah, and I don't know. I just did a couple. I've got two I just put up about Springfield, Massachusetts. There's a guy named Nick Parisi that wrote a book And then there was a lady, Pasqualina, about Pasqualina Albano, who was married to the guy who has a different name, the King of the Bootleggers at one time. And he got killed by this Nick Parisi, who wrote his own book. He got killed by Parisi's ancestor, Joseph, I think, Joseph Parisi. So I'm doing the old days of the Springfield mob here in the next couple of weeks. So
Springfield's really interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, it is. And you know, I found out how come it's still kind of influenced by the Genovese family is because of this Pasqualina married a guy from the Genovese family, but he was a weak sister. But he brought some of his relatives out, and he died, actually, of natural causes, I think. But the Genovese influence never left Springfield, Massachusetts.
There's a gal on the Mob Beat, a reporter. I'll talk to you offline. Does a great job on the Mob Beat up there. I've recommended everybody. I'll have to dig her name up. But that, you know, there's some great mob journalists that are still around. Yeah. And if y'all dig a little bit, you can find them. There's some good mob writing still, and it's been going on for a while. So.
Yeah, really. I tell you, the guy that I'm always impressed by, and he only does New York stuff, a guy, he writes under Ed Scarpo.
Yes.
He is really, really good and really detailed. He knows a lot of people. He's the one that really hooked me up with Michael DeLeonardo out of the Gambino family when I got the chance to interview him. But this guy's got sources like you can't believe. I'm always impressed with him.
Yeah.
All right, Cam.
All right, brother. I really appreciate you.
Finish this off. Guys, you know that I like to ride motorcycles, so be sure and look out for motorcycles when you're out there. And if you have a problem with PTSD and you've been in the service, get on the VA and get that hotline number. And hand in hand with PTSD comes problems with drugs and alcohol. Well, we've got Anthony Ruggiano, former Gambino soldier that has a drug and alcohol. Well, he actually works in a drug and alcohol place down in Florida, and he's got a hotline on his Facebook or his website. So be sure and like and subscribe and give me a review and do all that kind of stuff. Tell your friends about the podcast. And you can't check out the Gangland Wire podcast group anymore. So find me on Facebook if you're interested, and I'll invite you to join. We had to go private. We got too much stuff going on. I just couldn't take it anymore. It's a big podcast group. It's got a lot of really interesting discussions from people who are, you know, grew up in the neighborhoods or had relatives that were involved in different families, whether it's Chicago or New York or Kansas City or whatever. I even had a Kansas City mob guy on there who ran another Kansas City guy that's kind of a periphery guy off because he posted up some pictures. So he scared him. So I got a Kansas City mob guy on it too. Anyhow. All right, Cam. Thank you.
Let me do a quick plug. I've got my book, Swan Song, with Frank Calabrese Jr.'s wife. Swan Song, sort of a real Chicago mob wife. It's a great, great, great story of a different take on a story for a mob wife, telling how a strong woman dealt with a hitman as her father-in-law. And I really think everybody should check it out. It's a good look inside a mob family from a view that you don't see very often. So
yeah. It's a great book, folks. I've read it. We've got, if you look up, I've got an old interview somewhere in the last year, 2 years. I don't know. You can find it on the, just search for Lisa Swan, Camillus Robinson, Gangland Wire. You'll find that interview too. But yeah, it's a really good book. I hear she might go out and do a show in Las Vegas with Frank Calabrese. Her husband, her ex-husband is out there.
He's pushing for it. I was out there last week. I went to the Mob Museum, and Gary, you hooked me up with the guys out there, and I talked to them, and they're all about it. And like I said, Frank is their mobster in residence.
Yeah.
Universities have their writers in residence, and the Mob Museum has their mobsters in residence. And he's out there, and he's pushing for it. And I talked to her, and she would be really excited about going out there. So I think it would really be a great opportunity to have this husband and wife talk about how they lived the life and what went on behind closed doors in the world of hitmen. Man, loan shark, all around horrible guy, Frank Calabrese Sr.
Yeah, it's her description of that guy. So I tell you what, I guess you just live through things you don't know when you live in that life, you don't know the danger and what you're really dealing with. I mean, she knew, but you know, you're part of it. You know, it's a fascinating book, and I hope they can get those guys together there. Plus, it'll give them a big plug for your book too. So, always want to make that money. You know, give me that money, baby. Make that money. All right, Cam. Thank you.
Take care, Gary.